Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. The court meets today to hear one oral argument. State of Texas, McLennan County Democratic Party, and John Culler versus David L. Hodges from McLennan County. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The appellants may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. Three judges are unavoidably not here for oral argument, and I expect that some but not all of them will be able to participate in the final decision of this case. We are recording these arguments, and you may purchase an audio tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the clerk of our court. We're ready to hear argument from appellants.
May it please the court, it is Julie Carson and I'm arguing for appellants. Appellants have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Faced with disqualification as a Democratic candidate on the general November election ballot, because he voted in the Republican primary, Judge Hodges asserts that Section 162.015 of the Election Code is unconstitutional as applied to him because it severely burdens his right to vote. But Judge Hodges mischaracterizes the burden here. 162.015 does not severely burden his right to vote. It is a restriction on his candidacy, and any restriction or burden on his right to vote is secondary. But what he is really asserting here is the right to be a candidate in one primary and yet vote in another party's primary, and that right simply does not exist. Because the statute does not impose a severe burden on any right, the state's important regulatory interests in ensuring the stability and integrity of the election processes and in assuring the protection of the associational rights of the political parties justify any restriction on Judge Hodges' candidacy.
Let me ask you, what would be wrong with constructing a narrow rule? And specifically, I'm concerned about the as-applied challenge. If we were to construct a narrow rule and interpret the statute under the as-applied challenge to only allow him to be a candidate if there is no opposition in either party or as a write-in candidate, then what interest does the state have in precluding that result?
There are still the interests in the basic integrity of the political process being harmed and in voter confusion as to which party he's actually affiliated with.
Well, how can that happen if he's completely unopposed?
It can happen because the voters in the primary would be confused as to why he voted in the Republican primary in the first place, as to whether he holds those ideologies or still the ideology of the Democratic Party. And that confusion still exists regardless of whether he has opposition or not. And kind of to back up a little bit and explain, this restriction is just an extension of the basic restriction placed on any voter. Any voter that votes in a primary is confined to that political party for the remainder of the political cycle. You can vote in that primary and that runoff, and you can't cross over and vote in the other primary's runoff if there is one. When you have a candidate, that candidate is more visible than the members of the general public. There is a heightened public scrutiny given to people who are seeking leadership in a party or who are already leaders in the party. And the sheer fact that a leader of a party crosses over to vote in another party's primary creates turbulence in the system. It obviously would cause some consternation among both members of both parties as to why someone was going from one party and voting in the other party, regardless of the motives, regardless of whether they had an opposition or not.
Why shouldn't we leave that to the Democratic Party to decide if they want to put him back on the ballot?
Because even though the Democratic Party in this particular instance may not have any ill motives, there may be a situation that would occur where a candidate would do this and the party would be complicit in that and put them back on the ballot, regardless of whether they had an opponent or not. And as an as-applied challenge, even in the context of an as-applied challenge, the fact that the state has legitimate interests in preserving the statute as a whole justify the statute and the burdens placed on their candidacy by that statute, even if they all didn't appear in that one particular as-applied challenge. And that's the Monroe case, which was an as-applied challenge, in which the court, U.S. Supreme Court, said, we've never required a state to empirically prove that every one of its interests underlying a regulatory statute in terms of election processes was met in any given situation.
Why shouldn't we interpret the statute as Judge Hodges argued? And if his interpretation is a reasonable one, why shouldn't we give it that interpretation in order to enhance voter choice?
Well, first, his interpretation isn't reasonable, because his interpretation is essentially that if he is a candidate in one primary and votes in the other primary, then he can now be the candidate in either primary. And that's not apparent at all from the face of the statute. The face of the statute clearly prohibits you from being a party being a candidate for one party and voting in the other party's primary. He wants to read an additional word in there before or as a candidate to say parties as a candidate to get both parties, to get the plural for both parties, and that's just not available from the face of the record, from the face of the statute. Additionally, the regulatory construction given the statute by the Secretary of State's office is the reading that the state urges and that the district court found, found was unconstitutional, but found was the actual statutory construction, which is if you are a candidate in one party yet vote in the other party's primary, you're prohibited from being on the general election ballot as the candidate for the other party.
Do you agree that we have jurisdiction to decide that statutory question?
Yes, Your Honor, you do, because in the judgment, Judge Hodges is not seeking to change the judgment of the trial court. He is simply asserting another independent ground for affirmance of the trial court's judgment. So I believe under Rule 25 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure that there is jurisdiction for the statutory construction argument.
I can see the state's interest in trying to bring order to the primary and general election process, but it's awfully hard to see how this statute furthers that, if at all, very much. I can understand why the state might have an interest in preventing crossover voting and voting in one primary and then voting in the other party's runoff. But if the state has an interest here, it seems awfully slight. What really interest does this further that the state has?
It really furthers the stability and integrity of the election process.
It just doesn't seem to me like it's going to fall apart if we let candidates do this sort of thing. I can understand that it might impair it significantly if we let people vote just willy-nilly. I can understand that. But how is this going to really hurt you?
It hurts the process because it allows someone, it's not the broken record, but as I said before, someone who's a leader in one party to cross over to vote and select, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, the standard bearer of a party for which he is obviously ideologically diverse. It harms the associational rights of the political parties themselves because that is exactly what he's doing. Even though it is not his own race that he's voting in, he voted in a district court race for his friend and Sunday school teacher. And even though it was an act of friendship and not something malevolent, it still works to have him, as a Democrat, electing the Republican Party's nominee. And that, in and of itself, is harmful to the process.
It seems to me that if we gave the party the choice of disqualifying, that would protect associational rights. But to tell the party you can't have him even if you want him, it seems to me it may impair associational rights as much as it protects them. And you just can't tell.
But again, you could have a situation where the party itself was complicit in whatever mischief was going on with the cross-voting. And in this circumstance, the state has an interest in keeping people aligned along their party lines regarding for that 8-month period between March and November. And that's all the state requires, is that they remain. You vote in the primary, you're affiliated, and you're affiliated through whatever party processes there are thereafter. And if he did cross back over and was the Democratic candidate, at the end of the day, you would have someone affiliated with the Republican Party as the Democratic candidate, which does harm to the two-party system.
The law said you couldn't be a candidate if you had voted in the other party's primary for the last two cycles or the last three or four cycles?
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that's unconstitutional. A 23-month restriction on affiliation is unconstitutional. But a 9- to 11-month restriction has been held to be constitutional. And this is, at most, an 8-month. Because it doesn't count during off-ballot years, and although Judge Hodges attacks that as being under-inclusive, it's actually constitutional, because for the state to require him to hold that affiliation for an extended period of time without being able to switch, then it would run into constitutional implications. There's also, in terms of the under-inclusiveness argument, there's also a good reason why that statute doesn't exist, and that is the ability for the parties to make their own decisions in that regard. If he had done this in an off-ballot year, it would likely become a campaign issue. The voters would know why, he could explain, and they could determine whether, as a matter of their voting preference, whether they thought that was an adequate reason or not. But as it is, the voters never got the chance to make that determination. They were voting for him in the Democratic primary when he was voting in the Republican primary. And because that occurred, there's been no ability for the voters to actually make up the party, and not just the party leadership, to determine whether they believe he is still ideologically the candidate they would choose to vote for. It also doesn't give anyone the ability to say, I am more ideologically aligned with you, or he's not a Republican, I am, you should vote for me, and oppose him in that election.
It seems to me that argument is stronger if we had a primary system like other states that required people to register with one political party as opposed to another, and therefore actually have an association of Republicans or an association of Democrats, and then restrict their rights on which primary you go to. It seems to me you have a stronger argument that the state has an interest in keeping registered Republicans from voting in the Democratic primary. But our state, about its only interest is your affiliation occurs when you vote in the primary or you sign some sort of affidavit of affiliation, but it has nothing to do with whether you're a candidate. And they're all really only interested in holding that through that general election cycle, essentially. And then you're free to vote in somebody else's primary afterwards. So all the arguments about the association that seem to me the Republicans under the statute can't assert they have the right to associate only with Republicans and not Democratic candidates if the mark of association is the voting in the Republican primary. Democratic candidates can vote in the Republican primary. There's nothing that keeps them from doing so by law or otherwise, and so the Republicans don't have an argument that we don't want to have Democrat candidates at our state conventions because they're eligible to be there the moment they run in the primary. So the only thing that happens is, I guess, the Democrats have the right to insist that whoever represents them on the ballot in the general election has not voted for a Republican in a primary before that general election. Because that's all that happens here. If I file as a candidate in the Democratic Party, that's not an affiliation with the statute.
That's correct.
So I just do that. I then go and affiliate with the Republican Party by voting in the Republican primary. The result of the statute is I now cannot represent the Democratic Party on the ballot. So it seems to me the interest that's being protected is the Democratic Party's right to keep their candidates from voting, from affiliating with another political party. So it seems to me that's the interest that's here. do they have the right to keep their candidates from voting in the other party's primary?
Certainly, under the Democratic Party versus Jones case, that is exactly what the U.S. Supreme Court said, that the right to association means anything. It means the right to disassociate with people of unlike ideology and to require that people who vote in your primary are people who will at least affiliate with your party. So that is a valid interest. But there is also a valid interest, as I previously stated, for the Republican Party to have people, to not have people of unlike ideologies choosing their standard bearer. And simply because the legislature chose to use a less restrictive system than some other states did is simply a policy choice on the part of the legislature.
But the Republicans can't stop a Democratic Party candidate from affiliating with the Republican Party, because they can do that just by voting in the Republican primary.
That's correct.
So that interest is not before us here. It really is an interest, can the Democratic Party require their candidates to not vote in the Republican primary?
Well, I don't agree, Judge Enoch, that the Republicans don't have an interest the way this sets up, that the Republican Party's interests are not also impacted, because under the system, you're really talking about cross-voting and party rating, and under the system that the legislature has put together, the legislature assumes that the persons of one ideology are going to want to cast their vote in that particular primary.
But that just doesn't happen. I mean, people vote, lifelong Democrats vote in the Republican primary because the same reason this judge did. They have a friend there, and vice versa. If all the action is in a particular primary, it quite frequently happens, so I'm told, that people vote in that primary just so they'll have a choice. But they would horrify them if they had to carry around a sign that said, I am one or the other.
But as a matter of public record, that's what they are. They've affiliated with whichever party they voted in that primary. Either their card is stamped or it's on the public record as that's who they affiliated with, and that is, as a matter of concern, that's who they are for that political side.
But aren't there examples where even the party at the top might have an incentive to support, even against their own party's candidate, the other party's candidate? Because that, let's say the Republican Party knows somebody who's in the Democratic Party but who supports more precisely and consistently principles that the Republican Party espouses. And that the person in the Republican Party, they would prefer not to be, the nominated or elected candidate. And if that's permissible and if that's happened, then why shouldn't we look at this as a similar situation?
Because, fundamentally, because the statute is reasonable and legitimate and non-discriminatory, and the purposes that it serves may not be served in that particular circumstances, or there may be some other reasons for the cross-party voting, but that is what the statute is really intended to prevent. It's intended to prevent someone in one party from going over voting in the other party's primary as kind of the leader that would either embolden other people to do precisely what.
But the party could make a statement that says, we prefer the Democratic Party candidate to our own, for whatever reason. They could do that, but the statute would still prevent the candidate from voting in the other party.
In the primary, that would be correct. That would be correct. But under those circumstances, simply because that may happen doesn't make this statute unconstitutional. This statute is only unconstitutional if it severely burdens a right. And it doesn't severely burden a right. This is actually, it's a restriction on candidacy. It's no less a restriction than if he moved out of the county and then was therefore ineligible. That wouldn't impact his right to travel any more than this impacts his right to vote. But there is, because it is a regulatory scheme, some impact on his right to vote. But because that burden is slight, the statute's not unconstitutional. The questions that are being posed about people cross-party voting and whether that's reasonable in some circumstances or not is really a matter of policy decision for the legislature to make. The legislature has decided in passing these election laws, that they don't want that to happen as a matter of general course.
But we, in the as-applied challenge, and again, this is following up on some of the other questions, in an as-applied challenge, we have to look to see if the particular prohibition is as narrowly drawn as it can be in order to promote the interest that's being asserted. And I am interested in, because the Republican Party cannot prevent someone, a Democrat, from coming and voting in the primary, it's hard for me to see how the Republican Party's associational rights would be disturbed or impinged by allowing the Democratic Party to determine whether to put him back on the ballot and look at it. It seems to me the only associational rights implicated are those of the Democratic Party in this particular case. And if you could address that concern.
Certainly. Well, two things. First, it does not have to be narrowly tailored unless there's a severe burden on a right. If it's not a severe burden,
so if
it's anything less than a severe burden.
If we were to find that it was a severe burden.
If you were to find
it was, that we found that.
Okay. Well, there are compelling interests. The compelling interests are really the integrity of the two-party system.
Yeah, I understand the overriding compelling interest, but in terms of narrowly being able to address that interest in an as-applied challenge, why couldn't we narrowly interpret the statute to allow the Democratic Party to put him back on the ballot since the Republican Party's associational rights are not implicated?
Because even though it's an as-applied challenge, if any of the state's legitimate compelling interests are present to support the to justify the statute, it is valid. And that's, like I said, that's the Monroe case. And in this
but
instance...
But how are they implicated here is what I'm having a hard time understanding.
Well, at the end of the day, who will be on the ballot in November if Judge Hodges is on the ballot is a person affiliated with the Republican Party will be the Democratic Party's candidate. And that in and of itself undermines the two-party electoral system. In the situation of Parker County, where there is an opponent in the Republican-Democratic primary, and the Democratic candidate voted in the Republican primary, the end result is going to be that there's going to be two people affiliated with the Republican Party at the end of the day on the general election ballot. That undermines the two-party system, and Texas has, the legislature has the right to determine that the election processes in Texas are best served by having a valid two-party system. And that is a compelling interest. The U.S. Supreme Court has determined that is a compelling interest. I think maybe what you're asking me, too, is about the as-applied challenge, is how that changes the test here. And as in this particular context, for these election cases, it really doesn't change the test at all. Simply because it's an as-applied challenge just means that it's as applied to his facts as being the person who voted from in the Republican primary and wants to be a candidate. It doesn't really get to his motives, and under the test, simply because particular interests are implicated under these facts or are not implicated under these facts doesn't prevent the state from offering a compelling interest being an overriding one. And also, in terms of the as-applied challenge, even as an as-applied challenge, we can't look to his motives because we are not permitted as a state to go behind a voter's vote and try to figure out why they did what they did. All we can do is look at the objective evidence.
I have no problem with that proposition, but it seems to me that that would be uniquely something that the Democratic Party could look at, and they could examine his motives and determine under their associational rights whether they want to keep him on the ballot or not.
But what you're referring to, too, is the leadership of the party, not the party in terms of the voters. The voters don't really have a choice here in that situation. And it's legitimate and reasonable for the state to determine that it's better that someone else who is not affiliated with the Republican Party and who has essentially signed on to those ideologies be actually the candidate for the rival party.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument of appellee.
May it please the court, Mr. Ray Barrett will present argument for appellee.
Please the court, my name is Roy Barrett and I'm here on behalf of Judge David Hodges. The state's argument in this case would have the court convert what is generically known as the sore loser statute in Texas that has legitimate public purposes behind it in most of its applications. It would have it convert that statute from a sore loser statute into a defrocked winner statute. It would have the court turn the purposes of the election code on its ear, which is to let the will of the people come through to prevail, and instead have the result be that 120,000 McClellan County voters are disenfranchised, cannot have any voice in the picking of their judge for the next 4 years. That's going to be picked by the party leadership of the Democratic Party.
Can the state, though, determine that it is permissible for the Democratic Party to have as its rule that our nominees for the general election will not affiliate with the Republican Party for the election cycle?
I believe it perhaps could.
Could
now,
they have
that's
a rule that
rule,
says
though.
That our nominee in the general election will not vote for a Republican in the Republican primary as a condition for them to be our nominee in that general election?
If the Democratic Party imposed that rule, which was a restriction on the right to vote, the Democratic Party, being an entity that would exercise, to some extent, a state power, would have to show that they had a compelling interest to restrict that right to vote.
So you disagree that the state, as a part of its compelling interest, can divide the people among those who vote as Democrats and vote as Republicans and prohibit one voting for the other. You disagree with those cases that say that there is permissible regulation on the right to vote if you're dealing with a nominating process for political parties.
I do not disagree with those, Your Honor, but I believe if you look at those cases, each of those cases is based upon or grounded upon a state interest in preventing party raiding. All of those cases, whether it's Pondyke's, whether it's Rosario, all of those cases go back, and the reason the court gave is to prevent party raiding. And party raiding has been described as either intra-party raiding between parties or inter-party raiding. Inter-party raiding is what would be involved here. In those cases, the courts have said you can place reasonable restrictions on the time in which you must affiliate before you can vote in the primary, for example. In one case, they said 11 months is a reasonable time. In another case, 23 months is an unreasonable time. But those cases are based upon the state interest in preventing inter-party raiding. Inter-party raiding is defined by the Supreme Court of the United States in those cases to be the organized switching of blocks of voters in order to affect the other party's primary system, so that you do not get in the other party a candidate that comes out that is really representative of the interest of that party. It's an effort to go over and interfere with the due election process by getting some nut elected as the nominee of the other party so you can beat him in the general election. Now, when there is a state interest in preventing that blocks of voters from going over, that's a legitimate state interest, and the state can impose that.
Isn't a reasonable extension of your argument at this point being that the state, wouldn't a reasonable extension of your argument be that every voter in Texas ought to be able to vote in both the Democratic and Republican primary?
That is allowed in some states, and the state of Texas could do that.
But wasn't that struck down in California Democratic Party versus Jones?
No, sir. What was struck down there was a primary system where everybody was on one ballot. There wasn't separate Republican ballots or separate Democratic ballots. It was a unitary ballot. All the people were on the same ballot, and you could vote from race to race for different people, and then the one that had the majority ended up being the nominee.
Wasn't the underlying purpose of that, though, was to prevent dual affiliations, which is what we have here? I'm having trouble distinguishing the U.S. Supreme Court's case there in Jones versus what we have here.
Well, again, the U.S. Supreme Court in that case said inter-party raiding is the state interest that justifies that restriction. They said it's inter-party raiding because you don't know whether the two nominees come out really represent the will of the political parties that are supposed to be putting them forth. So it's an inter-party raiding concern. It's a switching of votes, in that case, on a vote-by-vote basis rather than a primary-by-primary basis. And you're not sure that the parties come out with nominees that represent their interest. So it's grounded on inter-party raiding. Inter-party raiding has been defined by the U.S. Supreme Court in at least three or four cases to be the organized switching of blocks of voters to improperly influence the other party's primary election. David Hodges going into the privacy of the ballot box and casting one vote could hardly be called a raid. It could hardly be called anything that would affect the integrity of the election process. The Democratic Party of California versus Jones case is clearly, absolutely, unquestionably grounded on the state interest of preventing inter-party rating.
But wouldn't that require us to delve into each person's motive in voting in the primary?
No, it would not. Because motive here has no... The state has argued that David Hodges had innocent motives, but the court cannot draft a rule that would be related to the motives of the candidates. Too amorphous. What is the reason this statute is unconstitutional? It does not have any sore loser aspects as applied to David Hodges. It's constitutional in most of its applications. This is only an as-applied challenge under this fact.
Well, I would like to go back to my question explored a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Under the associational rights of the Democratic Party, it is your position that the Democratic Party cannot have, as one of its rules, that its candidate during an election cycle will not participate in the Republican Party by voting in its primary or attending its conventions or whatever. You're saying that under an associational rights view, that does not permit the Democratic Party to require its candidates in that election cycle to not participate in the other political party process.
No, sir, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that if the Democratic Party promulgated a rule that said none of its candidates can vote in the other party's primary, then the Democratic Party would have to show where it had a compelling state interest to support that restriction on a constitutionally protected right, which is the right to vote. Now, if the Democratic Party's rule was you can't vote in the other party's primary alone, they would have a significant issue. It would be a better issue because it would be a party issue, and that's not like the state of Texas denying access to a general election ballot, which is what we've got here. We got the state exercising its police power to deny access to the general election ballot on some amorphous idea of protecting party purity. If the Democratic Party did it, now if they combine that with if you get out and you campaign for other candidates, if you are disloyal to the party, if you hurt the party, then they would have a better argument.
Isn't that what this statute does?
No.
Isn't the effect of this statute to say that if you are a candidate for one political party in this election cycle, and you vote in the other party's primary, the nominating process for that same general election, you are ineligible to continue representing the party?
That's what it says.
Isn't that what it says?
It says. And in order for that to be constitutional, since it is a restriction on the right to vote, there has to be a legitimate state interest for that restriction.
It's a restriction on whose right to vote?
It's a restriction on David Hodges' right to vote.
Well, he has the right to vote.
It is a restriction.
And exercise.
It does not deny his right to vote. It does not absolutely prevent him from voting. But it is a restriction on the right to vote. In the Pondyke's case and the other case, the Rosario case, both of which involve the constitutionality of the pre-affiliation requirements. In one case, they said 23 months is too long and unreasonable and unconstitutional. In the other case, they said 11 months is fine and constitutional. In both of those cases, the person could go vote in the primary of the party they'd previously been affiliated with. They just couldn't vote in the primary of the party they wanted to affiliate with now unless they met those pre-affiliation requirements. Now, in both of those cases, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized that's a restriction on the right to vote. It is restricting you to voting only in the primary of the party that you've previously been affiliated with. In addition, in Baker versus Carr, remember the voting rights cases? And there was this dissolution of dissipation of the right to vote, to the dilution of the right to vote. I'll get it right in a minute. And
Starts with a D.
And in that case, the opponents of the position said, well, this is not a denial of the right to vote. The person could vote. They went and voted. Their vote was counted. And Justice Frankfurter, in dissent, said, I think that's right. They voted. Their vote was counted. That's not a denial of the right to vote or an effect upon it that's constitutionally significant. But the prevailing party was able to convince the U.S. Supreme Court that if you even dilute the effectiveness of the vote, then you have restricted the right to vote. David Hodges' right to vote, it is illogical to argue in this court that his right to vote is not restricted by the statute. This statute says that any person who wants to be on the general election ballot as the nominee of a political party cannot vote in the other party's primary.
Well, I can agree that this is a restriction on his right to his right to vote, but in the context of a restriction on his right to participate in a political party. This vote is not a vote for the person, the candidate, who's going to be the office holder and the elected official. This is a vote to determine who the nominee from a political party will be on the general election ballot. And it seems to me that it is not a simple answer to say, well, I can vote for anybody I care to choose, because that is inter-party rating. The Republicans are nominating their candidate, and so it ought to be the Republicans voting for their candidate. And it seems to me the parties can legitimately decide that we do not want our nominees to be participants in the other party's selection process for who the candidates will be on as their nominees for this general election. It seems to me that's not a significant restriction on what party you'll participate in, but it seems to me it's not a significant restriction on the vote for the official who will be the elected official for that office.
Well, Section 162.015 says, for example, to an independent candidate, if you want to be an independent candidate for Justice of the Peace in Hidalgo County, you can't vote in either party's primary. This statute restricts the right to vote. The issue is this restriction supported by a legitimate state interest? Now, is there a legitimate state interest in inter-party rating when you have only the candidate prevented from voting? The inter-party rating has to be a significant restriction. It has to be a restriction that is necessary to accomplish a legitimate state purpose if you're going to burden this constitutionally protected right to vote. Inter-party rating does not rise to the interest of burdening the right to vote unless the rating can affect the validity and outcome of the election process. Here, when you say a candidate, or even all people that are candidates, cannot go vote in the other party's primary, there's no inter-party rating justification for that. So what they have come up with, and the state doesn't even argue that in their brief. And you asked me about the Democratic Party? The Democratic Party has no rules that say he can't go vote over there. If John Culler, who's the chairman of the party, had gone and voted in the Republican primary, he would not have lost his chairmanship in the Democratic Party. Because he doesn't have to be on the general election ballot. He just has to be elected in the primary. He was elected in the primary. If the Democratic Party is so abhorrent about, my goodness, going and voting for Republicans in the other primary, and it just destroys all the leadership and all the integrity and ruins us, they don't even prohibit by their own rules their party chair from doing it.
Well, can you assert the Democratic Party's interest in that regard here?
No.
And it seems to me that if there were a rule within the party that says if a candidate is determined ineligible under this statute, and yet we have a rule within our party that says that we can nevertheless decide in our discretion to put them back on the ballot as our nominee, then I would see that we might be in a situation of weighing the associational interests and saying that it can be more narrowly tailored, but we don't have anyone here arguing that.
That's right. And another reason this statute is unconstitutional, the reason it goes a bridge too far, is in order to protect these alleged pie-in-the-sky associational rights of the party, the Democratic Party. And they're not really involved here and implemented and denied in a significant way, in a way adequate to deny the right to vote, but to the extent they're implicated here. This statute could be totally effective if it said one of either two things. One, if you go vote in the Democratic primary, if you go vote in the other party's primary and you've won the nomination, the party leadership, whether it be the state committee or the county committee, has the right to remove you from the ballot. That would be a significant restriction. It would protect party loyalty, party purity, protect against dual party affiliation, protect the associational rights of the party. You could just say you can remove them. This statute doesn't say you can remove them. It's the state of Texas exercising its police power to say you are dead, you are removed. Not only does it do that, it goes a step further. It says not only are you removed, we have exercised the police power of the state of Texas to say you can't even get back on the general election ballot because this statute denies you any access to the general election ballot. So the Democratic Party goes to pick their replacement nominee if this court overturns the trial court's
decision, they cannot pick David Hodges, even though 40 of the 50 Democratic precinct chairs say David Hodges has been a wonderful 20-year servant and we want to pick him. He hasn't harmed the party, really. So if we're trying to protect the associational rights of political parties, if we're trying to protect dual party affiliation in some sense, which is not prohibited by the code here, by being a candidate, or if we're trying to protect party purity for some general, generic reason of party purity, this statute is not narrowly tailored. It goes a bridge too far.
But the Democratic Party disagrees with you on that.
No, the Democratic Party, what do you mean the Democratic Party?
Well, their brief in this case takes just the opposite position. Well,
their brief in this case takes the position that they would not have the right to decide whether to keep him back. Because of the way this statute is drafted. This statute goes too far.
But they don't claim that it's unconstitutional on that basis.
Well, that may be because the Democratic Party leadership in McLennan County sees this as an opportunity to pick their own handmade judge.
Well, regardless, there's no one asserting that interest here.
Well, but the interest has to be asserted. This court has to determine, is there a legitimate state interest to support this restriction on the right to vote?
Well, you have
to determine whether or not the remedy applied by this statute is correct and appropriate, or is it overly harsh? Has the state used a method of restricting the right to vote that goes beyond what is required to protect the interest that is defined?
I understand that, but in terms of asserting associational rights, mm-hmm. the Democratic Party is not asserting any here. In fact, it's arguing for the constitutionality of this statute.
That's right, and I don't know why. And so I don't think there's associational rights of the party that are involved in this appeal, because they're not asserting. And
is it fair to say, based on your argument, that you're waiving the statutory vote?
No, I just haven't gotten to it, Your Honor.
Well, everything you've said is this statute prohibits this, does this.
Yes.
Let me follow up. Are you waiving your associational point?
I'm not. Am I waiving the associational
point? Well, are you not claiming then that this statute is violative of the Constitution because it violates associational rights?
I'm claiming it's violative of the Constitution because it restricts the right of a person to vote when there's no legitimate state interest to do so. And I'm claiming that the associational rights of either the Democratic or Republican Party in this case are not an adequate basis for this restriction on the right to vote when there's no evidence or indication of inter-party rating. The only time associational rights of the party has been held to be a sufficient reason to deny the right to vote is where there was organized switching of voting or the potential for that, so there was inter-party rating concerns. Just the general associational rights of the parties is not sufficient to restrict the right to vote. Also, I'm claiming that if that is what the restriction is intended to do here, then it goes too far and it is too harsh, and therefore it's unconstitutional because the state has applied a remedy, denial of access to the general election ballot, which is too far for these protections of associational rights. Now, with regard to the point about statutory construction, that is the first point I raised. I think that is a legitimate and correct point. This statute says you can be the nominee of a party if you vote in the primary or were a candidate. You can be the nominee of any party if you vote in the primary or were a candidate. Now, they say, well, you can't read it that way. They say it's not ambiguous. Well, John Culler testified when he first read it, he thought it meant that. Judge Hodges, when he first read it, thought it meant that. The district judge, in deciding the case, says this statute has problems and you have to ellipse the words. The state, in their brief, in order to get to the position they want when they tell you how to read it, have to add words to the statute. They do that in their brief. It is clearly an ambiguous statute. 5 times this court has said, if a statute is ambiguous, an election code provision is ambiguous, and it involves eligibility of candidates, it must be construed in favor of eligibility. 5 times you said that. Because we want the will of the people to prevail, and the will of the people does not prevail when they don't get their vote.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
With all due respect, counsel has not identified any right that is severely burdened by this statute. In fact, he essentially ignored the balancing test that the Supreme Court is required to be placed on these kinds of election challenges. And that balancing test is highly deferential to the state, and maybe that is why it's being ignored. But all it requires is that if there's not a severe burden on any right, then the state's legitimate, non-discriminatory, reasonable restrictions and framework in ordering its election processes are constitutionally valid. That is exactly what this is. It is a reasonable restriction on candidacy. It doesn't matter if party rating is present or not present under these circumstances. The fact is that there are other legitimate interests of the state in the first instance that are met. And second, the fact that it could prevent inter-party rating in another set of circumstances is not defeated by the fact that this is an as-applied challenge.
Take my question on. The question in this case could be framed this way. Can the state prohibit the nominee of a political party, I say the party itself, I mean this is governing how the parties pick their nominees, could as a requirement to be the nominee from a political party in the general election, could one of those requirements be that they not participate in the other party's nominating process during that election cycle, and in this case prohibit them from voting in the other party's primary?
Could the party make that rule?
Well, the state is making the rules about the two major political parties, but I'm just saying, could the state do that? Could the state regulate the party machinery in such a way that the party's nominee could be prohibited from voting for candidates in the other party's nominating process, the primary?
I think that would probably raise questions of constitutionality because you would be prohibiting them from actually voting. In the other party's primary, which is not what this statute does.
So that would raise the state would have to have a compelling reason for telling if the nominee for the Democratic Party cannot vote in the other party's primary under the statute, and you say if that was the way this was read, then the state would have to have a compelling reason for burdening that right to vote.
If it was a severe burden on the right to vote, then it would have to be a compelling interest. It would come forth a compelling interest that justifies that restriction. And under these circumstances, the compelling interest is the voter confusion, the validity of the election process itself. There are a myriad of state interests that are present here that judge...
I'm just saying, could the state do that? Could the state regulate the party machinery in such a way that the party's nominee could be prohibited from voting for candidates in the other party's nominating process, the primary?
I think that would probably raise questions of constitutionality because you would be prohibiting them from actually voting in the other party's primary, which is not what this statute does.
So that would raise the state would have to have a compelling reason for telling if the nominee for the Democratic Party cannot vote in the other party's primary under the statute, and you say if that was the way this was read, then the state would have to have a compelling reason for burdening that right.
If it was a severe burden on the right to vote, then it would have to be a compelling interest. It would come forth a compelling interest that justifies that restriction. And under these circumstances, the compelling interest is the voter confusion, the validity of the election process itself. There are a myriad of state interests that are present here that Judge Hodges has ignored simply because they do justify this reasonable, non-discriminatory statute, and therefore it requires it be held constitutional. Simply because Judge Hodges made what he believes now may be a regrettable mistake doesn't bring this constitutionality of this statute into play. It is a constitutional statute that does not severely burden anyone's right under this program, and therefore it is constitutional and the trial court's judgment should be reversed.
What if the statute provided that if a candidate voted in the other party's primary, the candidate's party could elect to remove them from the ballot? Wouldn't that protect all interests here, all state interests here?
To go back, that wouldn't be necessary to reach that unless it was a severe burden on his right. That would also require the state to, I suppose, hold some sort of a special election to determine whether to retain him on the ballot?
No. My question is, if it said that the party could decide whether to remove that candidate from the ballot, leaving it up to the party to decide whether they still wanted to associate. Wouldn't that satisfy all interests here?
It would still result in someone affiliated with the Republican Party being on the Democratic ballot in the general election, because that affiliation would remain regardless of what the Democratic Party wanted to do. And that choice, as well as most of the choices that were discussed by counsel and that have been posed as questions by the court, really are policy questions best left to the legislature. The legislature created this system in order to prevent the interests as set out in our brief, and those interests are reasonable and non-discriminatory. And because they are reasonable and non-discriminatory, they are therefore constitutional.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in this cause. Mr. Marshall will now join the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.